I'm walking down the path in my garden, and I have a suggestion for you on how you could help with global warming. With a large lawn, I found a simple way of making a big difference. I sold my ride-on mower and bought a top-of-the-range Kress robotic lawnmower. It runs off rechargeable batteries and uses cutting-edge technology to mow and maintain a lawn this size. The petrol mower has gone, and with it, the emissions. I actually don't know why I didn't sell the ride-on sooner. With the Kress robotic lawnmower, the lawn is actually looking better. The tiny grass cuttings fall into the grass roots, helping to fertilize the grass. And the family doesn't have to put up with the noise and fumes from the ride-on. And I've freed up more of my time to spend with them and in the garden. It's an easy step. And you could also be making that change today. Ask for Kress in your local garden machinery dealer. Or visit kress.com.
I'm sure that we are one of the few people that dream about plants. I stay awake about plants, you know. When I think about combinations of design, I just think I'm not worried getting to sleep, you know. Seeing it realized, I think, is really sort of a birth of something new, euphoria, you know. It's,
it really is.
It really is.
Sometimes referred to as the greatest living landscape designer and a leading figure of the new perennial movement, that was the voice of Peert Udolf, the Dutch nurseryman, designer and author. Known for his work in iconic spaces such as New York City's High Line, Chicago's Lurie Garden and London's Queen Elizabeth Park, today we'll be hearing him in conversation with curator Matthew Pottage to unveil the concept behind his long-anticipated redesign for RHS Garden Wisley's glasshouse borders. Opening to the public in summer 2024, the Udolf landscape will boast over 160 different perennials and will help increase biodiversity at the garden. Very exciting indeed. We'll also be hearing about what it takes to propagate plants at scale as we take a tour of Wisley's propagation greenhouses with Sam Gallivan, team leader of the nursery and propagation team, who supplied a significant portion of the plants for Peert's project, as well as looking after Wisley Garden at large. All of this to come on today's episode of Gardening with the RHS with me, Gareth Richards. But first, do you know your bufftail from your Bombus hypnorum? Are your plant choices doing enough to bear them in mind? It's time to go bee spotting with our very own Helen Bostock.
My name is Helen Bostock and I'm Senior Wildlife Specialist at the RHS. So, yeah, I have possibly the best job at the RHS. So we look at a really wide range of wildlife, anything that really might be encountered in a garden situation. But of course, one of the really apparent types of wildlife, one that very much is a gardener's friend, are what we call pollinating insects. That means carrying pollen, helping the plant to set seed and maybe to set fruit. Within those, it's a really wide range of groups. So we're talking maybe 1,500 species at a minimum of pollinating insects in the UK. So our gardens are a real sort of hotspot for attracting in everything from hoverflies through solitary wasps and of course into bees. And bees is the topic which really gets people very excited, and for good reason. We have lots of bees in the UK. We are all probably familiar with the honeybee, but here at the RHS, we tend to focus a little bit more on what we call the wild bee species. So that can include 24 species of bumblebee and around about 250 species of solitary bees, some of which are very specific about the types of plants that they will visit. Our gardens have a very, very long season of flowering, and that is hugely valuable for bees. We tend to think of sort of late winter, spring, as a time when things are still only just starting to wake up in the garden, and that's true. But really, through our increasingly mild winters, some of the bumblebee species in particular can actually be staying quite active. So there's something called the buff-tail bumblebee, or Bombus terrestris. This is a type, given its name terrestris, it indicates that it likes to nest at or just below ground level, quite often seeking out something like an old burrow of a mouse. And the queens, which were mated the previous season, they will hunker down, but they can stay active. And if the weather is mild enough and there's available flowers. But as a general rule, spring is when things start to warm up. When the temperature reaches around about 12, 13 degrees, that's when we really start to notice a pickup in activity. Lovely thing about bumblebees is that their Latin name is bombus, and that actually means booming. So quite often, if you're out in your garden, perhaps you're kneeling down, doing a bit of weeding or something, it's often that you'll hear a bumblebee before you will see her, because they're really quite noisy. And that's really nice. You hear this big, low droning buzz. Have a look around and see if you can spot one. So our gardens are really, really important. The flowers in the first instance are going to be providing what we call nectar, which is a real sugar-rich substance that powers the flight, so the sort of wing muscles of bees, to get them going and give them energy. So we all need a good breakfast, you know, to get us out and about in the morning, and that's really what flowers are doing in the first instance. But then more than that, and this is where bees differ from wasps. Wasps will feed their larvae all sorts of meaty goods. So it could be like caterpillars or larvae of other things. They're true predators and they have a meaty diet. But bees are, think of them as the vegans of the insect world, because they feed their larvae the products of the flowers, which is the pollen. It's a really high protein source. So rather than a meat protein source, it's a plant protein source. And that pollen will help them develop the larvae through to develop fully into an adult bee. And that applies not just to bumblebees, it applies to all types of bee. So flowers are hugely important in the diet of bees. And as gardeners, we can help influence what we can provide for them and make all the difference in their ability to survive and to thrive. So we know that some bees have very particular tastes in which flowers they like to visit. Some of that preference is maybe determined by very physical things. So the length of your tongue, if you're a bee, for example, might determine how deep a flower that you can get into to reach the nectar. And it's the nectar that's going to be drawing them in. So some flowers, if you think of honeysuckle in the garden, it has this long tubular sort of rear of the flower. And that really suits itself only perhaps to a few of the bumblebee species, which have very long tongues. What's called the garden bumblebee is, or Bombus hortorum, is particularly noted for having that long tongue and can visit these deep throated flowers that have the nectar right at the very back. But other things are just because perhaps some bees have developed a connection or an association with only one or two types of flower. Some of the specialists might be things like the bryony bee, which is not often seen in gardens, but certainly along hedgerows and sort of the edges of field margins where you've got plant bryony growing through. In our gardens, we might see sometimes is something called the green-eyed flower bee. That bee does seem particularly to home in on the knapweeds, so this type of centaurea. And it's a good spot if you're trying to ever spot one of these bees to just sit quietly close to a patch of knapweed, perhaps if you've got a mini meadow. And they're very distinctive because they have these really iridescent sort of green eyes. Another bee that's a little bit smaller, but another one to look out for in a specific flower is what's called the campanula bee, or the scissor bee. So often mistaken perhaps for a small wasp or even a fly. It's quite dark, not quite so hairy as some of the other bees, and easily overlooked. But again, if you have a patch of campanulas in your garden, I would say on a sunny day, definitely get out there and just stop and have a good look. And often the bee is easy to see because being black, it's quite contrasting in either white or blue campanulas. So yeah, definitely have a look for that. And as we get later on, actually another bee that's really becoming increasingly common across gardens is what's called the ivy bee. So again, if the clue's in its name, it's got a real affinity for ivy. And that's because this time it's not to do perhaps with tongue length or how it's developed, but it's the time at which it emerges. So it's the latest of our solitary bees to be active in the season. And actually the main source of nectar and pollen going into that autumn period is our native ivy. So we already as gardeners know that our gardens are good for bees, but we want to drill down a bit deeper and actually determine which are the best plants at different times of year. We thought, you know what? We can ask for help on this. So here in our science team at the RHS, we've invited everybody to get out there and start spotting bumblebees for us this spring. So we have a special project which is called RHS Bumbles on Blooms, and it's really simple to take part in this. All we're asking you to do is to get out into your garden or local park with a camera or with your phone and just see if you can spot some bumblebees. And if they're visiting a flower, snap a picture of that and then submit it to our Bumbles on Blooms project on iNaturalist. iNaturalist is a really popular and very easy to use wildlife recording tool. If you know the name of the plant that the bumblebee was visiting, that's great, pop it on there. If you don't worry, we're going to be having a look at the photos and see if we can tell as well. The colour of the flower, so it's a nice easy one, and then how urban or rural the setting is where you took the photograph. And that's really just to help us investigate not only which flowers are bumblebees using in the spring period, but also are other factors influencing that choice of plants. Across the country, wherever you are, you can participate in this project, and it runs up until the 31st of May. So the data that we're gathering, it's all going to help us inform, first of all, our RHS Plants for Pollinator lists. These are lists that people can download and have a look at on our website. And also people might have noticed those little logos which are on certain plants. So that's the first thing. But also, it's going to be interesting to see what else we can find from the data. Is it going to help us perhaps give a top 10 of the best spring plants for bumblebees? And who knows, if this goes well, we might be able to run some other seasonal projects. So it's really hopefully a springboard for helping gardeners work with us to gather that data so that we can then get that out to as many people as possible. Some bumblebee species are doing quite well, but others are not as great. And declines overall in our pollinator populations have really been going in the wrong direction and been going down. So with this project, we're working with Bumblebee Conservation Trust, but it's really a collective conservation effort. And gardeners, whether we know it or not, are actually all real naturalists, and we can all help with that conservation effort. So yeah, we're going to help turn the tide and make sure that our gardens are working the hardest for our bees and other pollinators.
Thanks there to Helen Bostock. We'll leave a link to the Bumbles on Blooms project and the iNaturalist app in the show notes, where you can find out more on how to get involved. One of my favourite tips for a bee-friendly garden is don't forget that trees and shrubs can be really great for bees. If you think about a crabapple tree covered in blossom, or a flowering currant, or a hawthorn, these are plants that can give you an enormous amount of flower, and quite often over a few months they can provide a really valuable floral resource. I remember when I was a beekeeper, you would sometimes get areas of the honeycomb that were sycamore honey and things like that. You could actually see the different bits of what the bees have been feeding on. It is just amazing. And also, think about providing nectar over a long period. I mean, luckily for a gardener, this means having nice flowers to look at too, but think about having a really long display of single flowers as well. That's important. So if you think of like roses, if you have a double one where you have tons and tons of petals, there's not really anywhere for the bee to get in. Whereas if you have one of the single ones, like for example, a wild dog rose or some of the Rosa persica hybrids with those lovely blotches in the middle, they are brilliantly pollinator friendly. And finally, on the bees' tips, bees need water just like we do. So if you have a pond, a wildlife pond with gently sloping sides so they can get down and have a drink, or plenty of plants in there that the bees can land on so they can drink off. Sometimes you see bees landing on lily pads and just having a little sip. If you don't have a pond, consider making a bee drinker or something like that, where you have a saucer and you put pebbles in it and then you fill the saucer so the tops of the pebbles are poking out, and that provides a really brilliant drinking station for your bees. On to our next guest, legendary Dutch designer Peer Udolf, who's long been hailed for his melding of high design with environmental consciousness. Meadow Experiments at his Hummelo garden base in the Netherlands and countless designs for public places and show gardens have marked him out as a pioneer of the new perennial movement. Back in 2001, he created the renowned glasshouse borders at RHS Garden Wisley that have long been a draw for visitors. And this year, Pete returns to Wisley to complete a radical transformation of his own work, creating an immersive perennial paradise. It boasts an incredible 36,000 plants in his signature style of naturalistic grids and matrices, and the new Udolf landscape is now nearing completion ahead of its grand opening in May. Current Wisley curator Matthew Pottage met with Piet as final planting began earlier this month.
So my name's Matthew Pottage and I'm the curator here at RHS Garden Wisley. And today is a very exciting day. I'm joined by Pia Oudolf. We're on the new Oudolf landscape at Wisley and we are laying out plants and this is starting to look like a garden and it's been a long time coming. So Pete, are you as excited as I am?
Maybe more because you're here every day and just came in yesterday. And I think seeing it realized, I think is really sort of a birth of something new. It's sort of euphoria, you know.
It really is.
It really is. Yeah.
And for people listening at home, what are some of the big changes they're going to see from the old borders that they would have remembered that you laid out back in 2000?
Yeah, that was, of course, at that time in 2000, we were already busy for many, many years to create another type of gardens, you know, more naturalistic, we called it already. We came into more gardens that were more seasonable, that were interesting from spring till late fall, or even into the winter. Right? And now this is even more worked out. So that's, if you see between 20 years ago and now, I progressed. Yeah. I learned a lot of my own work and I met a lot of other people with a similar ideas and similar sort of way of looking into the future of perennial planting. And so what you see here will be the result of 20 years involvement in ideas we had already 30 years ago.
Yeah, which is, I mean, even, you know, when I'm looking around and looked at some of these plants, there's plants here that are new to me, there's cultivars that are new to me. And of course, I think as curator of Wisley, this has gone from being two borders to a whole new landscape. I mean, this is a landscape. And it's not just of planting combinations. You have matrixes, you have some block plantings. I mean, people are going to see different ways of laying out plants here.
Yeah, I think I used here all my techniques, ideas, and I could do it. This was big enough. And I think because Wisley is such a place for education that I thought I should do not one thing, you know, not one idea of putting combinations. It's just the matrices make it interesting. Also, the borders have plants that you probably have not seen in that combination you've before. And I think, so for me, it's also exciting. And I feel it's new. It's better than the former one.
Yeah, it's great. And for people at home, people are used to hearing the expression planting combinations, but they might not be familiar with planting matrices. Yeah. So can you give a very simple breakdown of how you would describe a planting matrix?
Yeah, matrix design is and it's just from the recent years that they call it matrix. I think it's an even more naturalistic design with perennials where you say you have a field of one or two or three species that dominate. And from that field of different species, little groups and individual plants emerge from. So it looks very spontaneous, and it looks very wild in a way, but it's also very controlled because the plants chosen are plants that don't push other plants out. Of course, it's a garden, every plant grows, but I think it's a controlled, wild planting idea, I think.
Yeah, so it's a very thought out community. The plants are complementing, they're not fighting each other. It looks very natural. Yeah. And I think this will be a really exciting new feature for people to see. And then just talking about our timescale. So here today, we're laying out, we're following your very beautiful and very complex planting plan. There's pots everywhere. And we'll start planting, and this will open to the visitors on May the 15th. But later this summer, people will see a result here, won't they? There'll be colour and flowers to see.
I think the overall landscape will look very interesting already and beautiful. So it's a bit skinny, you know, it's young. So some plants are keep small for the first years, but the other plants will just be abundant. And I think the overall landscape will look good. So I would say people come. and not only come because it is interesting, even that it's not mature.
Yeah, I think so. And I hope that many keen gardeners will be pleased to see the RHS using all these plants in 9-centimetre pots. We're starting everything small. These plants will grow suited to the conditions, so it's not everything in huge pots for day one impact. Yeah. But grasses and perennials, they do establish remarkably quickly. Yeah. And just to give listeners at home a sense of just how many plants are going in here, I mean, I can see pots as far as the eye can stretch, really. Roughly, do you remember how many?
I think between 37,000-40,000 plants. I think that's
a hearty number, isn't it?
It needs care, it needs skill, it needs gardeners, it needs stewardship.
Yeah.
So the size is right, I think, and you have the people here.
We do. We have a wonderful team here who are very excited to see all this taking off. And for people with a small garden at home, if they're thinking, well, there's nothing in this for me, it's a huge landscape, of course people can see some of these combinations or matrices and make notes
they can make notes. You know, the groups are bigger here, but if you choose for yourself which plants you like, you can put them together in the garden the amount and quantity you like.
I mean, as curator, I want people to come in here, say wow, get off their phones, start enjoying plants, look around them and feel inspired by plants. Yeah. You know, the garden is only as good as its plant collection, and I feel inspired, and these things aren't even really growing yet. So I know later in the summer, people will be blown away.
Yeah, I'm sure that we are one of the few people that dream about plants, or not.
Yeah, I know I certainly do. I've had this problem for a long time.
I stay awake about plants, you know. When I think about combinations of design, I just think, and I feel I'm not worried, not getting to sleep, you know.
I think it's a good thing to be distracted by. Yeah. There could be worse things keeping you awake at night, other than a planting matrix.
Too many things in the world nowadays, so.
I know. Best to focus on gardening. It's good for us all. So, Pete, when you're designing something like this, I mean, the scale of this is epic. How do you go about curating a plant list? I mean, how did you think what's going to work here at Wisley?
No, it's easy for me to visualize my own work. So if I have an idea, then I see it in front of me, you know. You have a visualization, and then you make a list of plants that you want to use in that matrix, and that's the starting point. And then you start composing. It's more composing, so you start with a yarrow, and you put little group there, group there, group there, and then you take another in, for instance, a Baptisia. Baptisia, you know how big it will be, and just say, okay, not too many, so one here, another one there. So that's how you compose. And then at the end, you fill it in with this sort of the larger quantities of the plant that dominates that area.
And how do your planting lists evolve? I mean, how do you get new additions? Do you go to trials? Is it talking to friends? Is it seeing things on?
No, I see gardens. I see people with plants. I follow sites. I go to nurseries. Yeah. Look at plants. A plant need to be really special to be able to push another plant out.
Another one off the list. Yeah.
Because there is so much in the trade which is important for the trade to. So there's a new color, a new edge on a plant, there's a new dot on a leaf, there's a new spot on a flower, that's all new. But for us, it's not important. For us, important as a designer is that your plants are stable, that they stay put, that they're not invasive, that they just feel happy together with the plants around them. So it's about a habitat, and maybe not a natural habitat, but a habitat where plants like to grow together in, so it's like a community.
Right plant, right place, knowing the plant, knowing the cultivar, and obviously having some good gardeners to jump in and help out either when things need splitting and dividing.
Just splitting,
or
dividing, and so we, there's a garden in the Netherlands run by volunteers, and they maybe not the best gardeners, but what they do, they stick to the design 100%. Every time they're dividing the yarrow, you know, the agelias, and bringing back everything to proportion, so then garden will never change.
No.
That's also not my idea about gardening, you know. It should change, and I think you could, I don't mind if we lose species if the aesthetics are still there.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it's that balance, isn't it, of maintaining the spirit of it, but
spirit,
not going too far away from the design, but also it not being static.
That's what we try to achieve, you know, that's a living piece of art, eh? You can say that.
Yeah,
and if it's alive, it may change.
Thanks there to Pierre Udorf and Matthew Pottage. The grand opening at RHS Wisley will be on the 15th of May. To find out more about the design and see it for yourself, we'll leave a link in the show notes with all the information you need. It's going to be really interesting to watch that garden develop from those small, slightly spaced out plants to start with, which are just going to grow and billow and fill the space with this amazing wave of planting. And that speaks to something that I really love about Pierre's planting, is that the way he uses these matrices and the repetition of plants and that rhythm, that has lessons for all of us, even in a small garden. By repeating plants across your space, you can make the space feel bigger and you can get a lot more impact. As we heard, there's going to be something like 36,000 new plants going into this area. If you've ever wondered, how do you grow that many plants? How do you grow at that scale? Well, we've got the answers. We're going to talk to Sam Gallivan, who's the team leader of the nursery and propagation team. She's here to give us a behind-the-scenes tour at Wisley, where the magic happens.
My name is Sam Gallivan. I am the team leader of the nursery and propagation team here at Wisley. We have two roles. Firstly, and probably the largest role, we produce plants for the garden. So each team uses us like a nursery or a garden centre that you'd go to buy plants. So they will come to us, but they put an order in, request certain quantities. We produce them, hopefully. And then they take them away when they're ready and when the weather's good and they can get them out into the garden. At the moment, we are standing in our first of four greenhouses. Each one is different temperatures so that we can acclimatise the plants before then putting them outside. So this first greenhouse is where we do all the propagation. We have a mist bench, which has spray nozzles, which dampens the plants down so that they don't get too dry, and it enables the seedlings to germinate well. And there's a little bit of heat underneath as well so that we can tickle them into growth, a bit of enthusiasm. And so this house is quite warm. It's a nice 18 degrees, and that enables us to grow things on and get them ready. So at the moment, we've got a wide range of chilies that are being grown for the edibles team. We started them probably about 5 or 6 weeks ago now. So we've put an individual seed in a cell, in a tray, and they've germinated and we've got them growing on now. We'll be potting them off soon. And we also have a wide variety of different seedlings germinating, from zinnias, calendulas, digitalis. Oh, I think we've got poppies over there. We've got some chard growing further up. So it's a real mishmash of edibles and pretty and bedding and annuals and herbaceous. It's an absolute mix. Every year is different. So once we hit March, everything gets very busy. So all the seedlings will start to germinate. And so we have to prick them out and we have to get them ready. Then we have a lot of potting to do. So also in this greenhouse, we've got the tender perennials. So that'll be things like salvias, begonias, tradescantia, we've got fuchsias that we grow for mainly the formal team that go into the mixed borders in the garden and the exotic garden. And so we propagated these last August, September time. And these have been growing on in this greenhouse and they're in a little, what we call a liner or a 9 centimetre pot at the moment. We're cutting them back, tidying them up, and then they will go into their final container, which will be a 2-litre pot. So that's about the average size you'd buy in a garden centre. They will be ready for the teams to take out into the garden the end of May. Let's move into our second greenhouse. And this is slightly cooler, but this is used to grow on all the seedlings that we have produced from when we do the seed sowing. So once we've pricked them out and we've got them into the container that we want to use, and at the moment we're using a lot of pots. So they're made of coir and we use these for a lot of quick to root plants that they can then just take out into the garden. They can pop them out from their trays, put them into the ground and they don't have any plastic or anything over them. The only thing we asked is that they bring the trays back and we can reuse them, because we try to be as sustainable as possible down here. And so we went over to these Jiffy pots to try and reduce the amount of plastic. We do still use plastic, but it's not one use. So some of our pots, I can hand on heart say that they're probably about 15 years old, and we just wash them every winter and reuse them. Everything we do down here is peat free and has been for probably about 25 years or so. The compost we use at the moment is Melcourt, and we use their seed and cuttings mix. But you can use the Melcourt silver mix to use. I do it at home, and it seems to work quite well. We don't add any feed to it. We just sow, let the plants germinate, and then we prick out quite quickly. I think that's the biggest thing. People often wait for seedlings to get too big before they prick them out. But we actually prick them out really when they just have two leaves, and that is it. And it enables them to be pricked out without being too stressed. The lettuce don't seem to mind. They seem to be very happy. And so we've been doing that for quite a few years now, and we find it to be exceedingly effective. Each of the benches are broken up into the different teams that have requested. So the World Food Garden is winning with all their plants on one bench. But we also have plants of the woody team. So we're looking at foxgloves, digitalis. We're looking at a lot of the dried flowers that are used in the heather garden that one of the welcome team uses to do the cut flower displays. And we also do have some rather ginormous begonias in here. And those we've been growing for 2 years now. They will be going into the exotic garden this summer. We're in our third house. This house is, again, slightly cooler. We keep dropping by a couple degrees every time. This is sort of plants that have been with us a while, belong to somebody, or they could be stock plants that we hold down here because we know the plants in the garden may not produce the material that we want for cuttings. And so in here, you're looking at a range of fuchsias that we've got in here as stock plants. We've got a few salvias in here that are new to the garden. We have a little tender lavender collection. So these are lavenders that are a lot more tender than your usual Lavandula angustifolia, which is the British lavender. And also we've got citrus, and these citrus plants, they were some of the plants that we overwinter. That's another part of our job. When the teams get ready for winter and they have some plants that we pop outside that look amazing during the summer, they won't like our winters, the wet more than the cold. And so we've got a range of citrus here from oranges, lemons, grapefruit, and they come from the garden. We've put them inside. We're looking after them. We're making sure they get fed and watered. And then when they look lovely again, they'll be pushing them back outside. And then next winter, they'll be trundling back down here again to their winter home. And then finally, this is greenhouse 4. And again, we've really dropped now. This only gets to about 6 degrees, but it's warm enough that the plants that we have in here will happily survive the winter. But we don't want them to grow a lot. We don't want them to put on lots of lush growth. So in here, we've got things like the red bananas that are in the exotic garden. Some of the solanums will come in. And we've also got lemongrass, we've got olives, all sorts of things for the, again, for the edibles teams, so that they can then come and pick them up again, trot them back up to the garden, put them in the ground. And then strangely enough, next September, October, we'll be doing exactly the same again. I've been doing this for, since I was 16, so I've been doing it for over 30 years now. I would say to people, don't give up if it goes wrong the first time. We all make mistakes. Even now, we don't always get it right. I would say probably the biggest thing nowadays, especially with the peat free coming in, find one that works for you. If you've been using peat beforehand, don't treat it in the same way. A lot of people have struggled with that. And so when it comes to the watering, forget what you learnt with the peat and start looking at your peat free very differently, because a lot of people overwater and they wonder why things don't work. So find one that works for you. Just because it works for your neighbour doesn't mean to say it works for you, because you are very different in the way that you manage things. And yeah, don't be too technical. You don't need a lot of technical stuff. You don't need to go out and buy all the latest gear. A little propagation box with maybe a little bit of base heat is lovely, but you don't necessarily need it for a lot of what you're going to do in your garden. And keep things simple. Start with stuff that is got a good percentage chance of germination. Start with the simple seeds, start with the calendulas, start with that sort of stuff. Get a feel for it and then get more technical, then have a bit more play and try things out a little bit more. But I think that was my best advice, really.
Thanks there to Sam Gallivan. To find out more about plant propagation, we have a whole host of tutorials available on the RHS website. At the moment, I'm thinking about daylilies and hostas and agapanthus, dividing these perennial plants, which are all just starting to grow. And there's a really good rule of thumb here. So the bigger and the bulkier the plants and its roots, the more rough you can be with it. So for example, daylilies. We had a fire on the allotment. Someone's shed burnt down and they had daylilies around it. And the shed is long gone, it's a wreck, but the daylilies have all begun to spread up and they're just, nothing stops them. They are really, really tough plants. So for things like that, they will make a big chunky rootstock. And actually to divide a daylily, you can dig it up with a spade and you can chop it into bits with a spade. Agapanthus are kind of the same, they're pretty tough. Whereas plants like hostas and heucheras have slightly smaller and finer root systems, so dig them up with a spade, but then pull them apart gently so you don't damage them too much. And then you can replant across your garden and it plants for free. It's really quick, it's really satisfying. And this takes me on to something else that I'm doing at this time of year in my garden, which is watering. I know we've had the wettest February on record and it seems mad to be thinking about watering now, but anything that you've recently planted, recently divided things like we've just been talking about, or anything that you've just taken out of a pot, it will still need watering. We need to keep an eye on these things for the next few months, particularly if we have dry, windy weather, even if we get the odd bit of drizzle. If it's been breezy in particular, these new plants will dry out, so water them carefully. Best thing to do is get a water butt, use rainwater, that's the greenest, it's also better for your plants. But yeah, just puddle the bases of them. You know, it's good to give them a decent watering once a week rather than spray them with a hose twice a week. So yeah, keep on top of the watering over the next few weeks of anything that's newly planted. It's also the time to plant other things such as potatoes, onion sets, summer bulbs like gladioli and lilies. But remember, if you're planting those, they don't need watering in. You can literally just bury them in the soil according to packet instructions and away you go. We had a recent question into the podcast inbox. Thank you, Samantha. She asks about autumn sown broad beans. Now, her broad beans haven't made it through the winter very well. They've been munched away by the slugs. Out of 20 plants, she only has 5 sorry specimens left. What can she do? Well, Samantha, you're not too late. Don't panic. You can still sow broad beans now. So I would sow I'd probably sow a dwarf one. I wouldn't necessarily go with Aqua Dolce Claudia, which is what you sowed before. I'd go with something smaller like the Sutton or Wickham Manita. The seeds are quite widely available. Or you can buy the plants in garden centres as well. So yeah, plant them out, grow a few extra, watch out for slugs. But yeah, don't worry, all is not lost. So remember, if you've got allotment questions, grow your own questions, horticultural questions you'd like us to address on the show, do send us your queries at podcast@rhs.org.uk. So that's all for now. From me, Gareth Richards, goodbye. Thanks for listening.
I'm walking down the path in my garden and I have a suggestion for you on how you could help with global warming. With a large lawn, I found a simple way of making a big difference. I sold my ride-on mower and bought a top-of-the-range Kress robotic lawnmower. It runs off rechargeable batteries and uses cutting-edge technology to mow and maintain a lawn this size. The petrol mower has gone, and with it, the emissions. I actually don't know why I didn't sell the ride-on sooner. With the Kress robotic lawnmower, the lawn is actually looking better. The tiny grass cuttings fall into the grass roots, helping to fertilize the grass. And the family doesn't have to put up with the noise and fumes from the ride-on. And I've freed up more of my time to spend with them and in the garden. It's an easy step. And you could also be making that change today. Ask for Kress in your local garden machinery dealer. Or visit kress.com.
Discover the beauty of an RHS membership all year round. Save 25% off an RHS membership today when paying by direct debit. Prices start at just £55.50. With a membership, you'll gain access to an array of special events at our gardens all year round. Be the first to know about RHS flower shows and get exclusive member-only days, plus reduced-rate tickets. And you'll have the chance to enhance your gardening know-how with access to free expert garden advice, monthly editions of the Garden magazine, and so much more. Terms and conditions apply.